This is the Disaster Recovery Hour. Here's your host, Chris Plunkett.
Hey, good morning. It's Saturday, 7 a.m. On the 970 The Apple, talking New York. The show is Disaster Recovery Hour. I'm your host, Chris Plunkett. The premise of the program is talking about preparedness for when disasters enter your life through fires and floods and structural collapses and pretty much just mayhem. I want to thank my guest last week was Captain Dan O'Brien from the Emerson Fire Department and also Chief Fedorchek from the Westwood Fire Department because we just ended fire prevention slash week slash month. Like I said before, I think a week is a little too short on preparedness when it comes to life and death myself, but that's just my opinion. So again, thanks to those guys. It was a good rocking show. A lot of good tips, and I know the website got hit for information regarding it with the comments page. But, you know, the program today is going to go a little different direction. A couple of weeks ago, I had Daniel Andre, who was the president of the Haitian Civic Organization of Patterson. We were talking about that he's a Haitian, obviously, and he has family and relatives down in Haiti and were affected by the earthquake. I just met a couple of people through the old internet that are my guests today. It's Paul Wagner and Paul Sebring. So, guys, you guys hit the ground down there just after the earthquake. And so why don't we start with Big Paul. Paul, why don't you give us a little detail on how that transpired?
I was sitting in my office. I'm a photographer back home in Arizona. And sitting at the computer, and I saw that the earthquake had hit and decided that I needed to go down there and help out. So I went through and contacted a lot of the large organizations to see if I could piggyback on with them. I do have some medical training, but all that expired about 12, 13 years ago. So I told them that. They said, thanks, but no thanks. So I just booked a flight and went down to Dominican Republic. Met a guy down there that was going into Port-au-Prince, into Haiti, actually. Hitched a ride with him and a pastor. Spent the first night under a guard shack at the Dominican Republican border. Got to the mission the next day, spent the night there. And on day three was actually day three of my journey, not day three after the earthquake, was in Port-au-Prince at Haitian Community Hospital. And I was completely outmanned when it came to medical. There were doctors, surgeons, nurses, everyone there. But there was no one handling the supplies or the logistics of anything. So took that out and started working on that. And that's where I met Little Paul.
Yeah. How about yourself, Paul?
I had just recently got off of work, sitting down, getting ready to have dinner, seen on the news the new reports coming over about the earthquake, what had taken place. Immediately felt like it was something I wanted to get into. Started making phone calls, inquiring with different NGOs about getting on and going into country with them.
NGOs? What are NGOs?
Different nonprofit, non-governmental organizations. And didn't really have any luck with that. Kept getting redirected, told, you know, it'd be better to wait and find somebody to go in with. You'd be more of a burden if you went in on your own.
Yeah, really?
So on and so forth.
So you're trying to help out and weren't being able to utilize your skills?
No. Habitat for Humanity gave me a opportunity. They told me if I was, you know, vaccinated, got my meds, and could, you know, get myself down there, that they could find a place for me when I got on the ground. I ended up getting, you know, redirected. The place I was camped out in after I made it over the border into Haiti had an orphanage right next door. I kind of got, you know, hooked into helping them. And still to this day, we're building them up. But just a few miles away was Haitian Community Hospital, where I'd met BP. And we hit it off pretty good, started working real good together, coordinating and getting different things, picking up doctors, nurses from the hospitals, airports, moving them back and forth, doing prosthetics and moving supplies.
Well, the you know, like I said before at the beginning, the show was turning into. When I read this article about this, the Haitian Civic Organization president, it reminded me a lot of what transpired down at Katrina. So I haven't stopped thinking about it. And I know we contacted you guys contacted us through the Twitter, and we got to get this meeting going and hearing the experiences and what's going on, because it's really still happening. And right, you still have tent cities and you have supplies that aren't being addressed. So Big Paul, you had EMT experience, so when you jumped into the hospital, you were able to do some things that are applicable from your trade.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like I said, it had been about 13 years since I practiced any of that. It all came back pretty quick, and then we were handling logistics initially, and then it started off that without having a 911 system or EMS program in Port-au-Prince, we were getting calls from these NGOs that were providing medical care saying, you know, we've got a patient that has, you know, a broken hip or a broken leg. We need to get him to an orthopedic surgeon. Do you know where there are any? So then little Paul and I would just make some phone calls, find an orthopedic surgeon in a hospital that could receive him, take over, pick up the patient, throw him in the back of our pickup truck, and transport him over to the hospital. And we evolved into basically the functioning 911 EMS system in Port-au-Prince.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, there's no, I mean, the infrastructure got whacked out. So were the locals, or was it all outside help that got them going? Was it 50-50? What was the percentage of getting things back in order?
In some cases, you do see people that are so traumatized, they don't really know which way's up and, you know, where they should go. But for the most part, I mean, even now to this day with, you know, not the equipment and the right kind of tools to clean up and rebuild and do, you know, whatever they can, there's still, if there's an accident on the side of the road and somebody's hurt, you know, you see a Haitian chauffeur for a tap-tap, which is a local taxi service or transportation service, you know, they'll pick another person up and they'll take them to the hospital.
So, little Paul, why don't we talk about MMRC, which is Materials Management Relief Corps. So you guys basically started your own nonprofit.
Yes.
Is that it?
Yes.
So how did you go about doing that?
Well, BP Moore had the vision. He went back a week or so ahead of me in March. When I got back to the States, we started having more contact on the phone. We were he told me what his plans were and what he would like to do. He established MMRC, and we came back to Haiti, set up at another hospital, and just went all out.
So there's got to be paperwork to be filled out to organize or something like that?
There is. What we did initially, since I only had about 2 weeks in country in the States before I was heading back to Haiti, did the trade name reservation, all that kind of stuff. And that's about as far as I got. So what we ended up doing was one of the doctors that we'd worked with while I was there got us in touch with a law firm out of San Francisco. And they are doing everything pro bono for setting up our corporation, doing all that kind of stuff, our legal tax status. You know, we haven't been approved yet. That's about a 6 to 9 month process.
Really?
Yeah. It takes a while, but they're getting everything processed for us so that we can be doing that.
Mm. If you just join us, this is Disaster Recovery Hour. I'm your host, Chris Plunkett. I'm with Paul Wagoner and Paul Sebring, with Little Paul, Big Paul. They formed a nonprofit, MMRC, Materials Management Relief Corps. Let's, you know, throughout the show, let's just keep on reminding these people how they can donate, whether time, materials, dollars. So how do they go about contacting you for that?
Easiest way to contact us is through our website, which is mmrcglobal.org. Want to say a huge thanks to Nancy Murdoch. She heard about us through an article in Men's Journal, and she has done amazing work to get us even on the show that we're on to today, and, you know, getting our website up and running and making sure that everybody knows what we're doing. And we do have a donate option there that you can just click on the button and donate through PayPal. We also, if you need to and you want to make a larger donation, we can get you the wire information, everything like that.
So, little Paul, you have a contracting business in Florida, and
My business is on Nantucket Island. I'm from Florida. I moved up there about 10 years ago, and started a few years back Wagoner Built Inc., which is now kind of in limbo until.
So it's literally you're sitting down having dinner, and you decide, hey, I got to rock and roll. I got to get down there.
Yeah, the hooks kind of got in me, and, you know, I was especially, you know, pushed more when I didn't have any luck getting on with anybody. You know, that just kind of lit the fire even more and pushed me to, you know, make moves and get it done. A couple weeks later, I was in the Dominican making my way to Haiti.
So we're going to go to break. This is a Disaster Recovery Hour. I'm your host, Chris Plunkett. I'm with Little Paul and Big Paul. You can shoot out some questions and whatever if you like on the comments page on the website, which is cppems.com. And we're going to get right back.
You're listening to the Disaster Recovery Hour with your host, Chris Plunkett, on AM 970, The Apple. And now back to the Disaster Recovery Hour on AM 970, The Apple. Here's your host, Chris Plunkett.
And we're back. We have to pay the bill, so you got to throw some commercials out there. My guests today are Paul Wagner and Paul Sebring. They have formed a nonprofit Materials Management Relief Corps, MMRC, for the Haitian earthquake. Now, you know what this is? That's a large-scale disaster. And what we talk about disasters on the show were Katrina or downtown with the towers. Like I said, I was reading this article a couple of weeks ago, and then I brought on that president of the Haitian Civic Organization. And then through the magic of the Internet, the Twitter, we came across Paul and Paul, and they came across Disaster Recovery Hour. And it's a good fit, and I think it's a good cause. And I don't think people realize that it's still happening. People are still living in tents down there. Like I was telling you, you know, with the Internet and the communication highway, the world has gotten very small. Everyone's a true neighbor now. So, Big Paul, why don't you give me day one when you landed and hit the ground?
Day one in Haiti, like I said, coming in, was up in the rural areas, got on a car 4 a.m., headed into Port-au-Prince, and everything kind of seemed surreal. It just, the destruction that a 35-second earthquake could cause, tent city after tent city, the smell, you could just smell decomposition everywhere. And it started to get a little bit more real. But for me, things got really real when I'm looking out the window of the car I'm riding in, and I see a dog carrying a human foot in its mouth. And that was kind of the shock that I needed to get my head right and realize what I was doing. We turned the corner, and what I saw was really disturbing. It was two dogs fighting over a human body that somebody had died. They're really going at it, trying to get this body tore up. And that's between the smell, between everything else. It was one of those things that just really shocked you into the fact that you're not in Kansas anymore. Put your game face on and get to work.
So I'm unsure, like myself, a lot of people don't realize that when it's just not that easy to volunteer, is it? It seems like you guys had some hurdles you had to go through. Right, Little Paul?
Most definitely. It didn't pay off right at first, but in the long run, after a few phone calls, you know, and started figuring out more, researched a little bit, and seeing that it was possible to make it in there on my own, I kind of just gave up on the, you know, search. Everything you Googled was a donate $5, you know, text this for this and that. It was no, you know, give yourself up for, you know, a month, 2 months. It was just strictly donating money. So after I seen that, I just took it into my own hands, purchased my ticket, and that kind of sealed the deal. You know, I knew then that I had to go ahead and finish getting prepared.
So it went. So who'd you go to volunteer? You saw the Red Cross, or you saw other nonprofits to try to lend a hand? How does that work?
My experience was pretty strange. My first day in Haiti, I had fortunately met up with a MIT grad, Pascal, that was coming in to Haiti from the DR. He was a Haitian fella. He heard me speaking English in the hotel. I told him how I was getting over there with my duffel bag and backpack. He said, you know, no way, you got to come with me. Introduced me to some friends when we got in country. My first day, I ran into another group that was doing some volunteer work at Haitian Community Hospital. I told them what I did for a living. We talked, and they needed help building different devices to get multiple amputees and different things back mobile, and ask if I could ever stop by and, you know, take a look and see if there's any way I could help them. About 2 days after that, I did. I went by the hospital. They happened to be 2 minutes from where I was camping, maybe three. Got roped right into there, doing a bunch of work. Met BP. We clicked real good together, and, you know, it was just gung-ho from there. We were all out.
Now, you're working side-by-side with the Haitian people also.
Yes.
I mean, they got obviously personal ties to this whole thing.
Absolutely.
For obviously reasons. So how is that organizational part of it? Is it, it's logistics, right? It's all about planning, right?
The coordination, planning, you got to, you know, you really have to know how to carry yourself. We're very fortunate to come across some terrific local people, Haitians, that were volunteering at the hospital. which we still have working with us today. You know, they're really dedicated to what they're doing, and you know, appreciate what we've given up to come there. And you know, they put in a lot and dedicate a lot of their time and efforts into, you know, MMRC and what our goals are.
So you got to wear a lot of hats down there. I mean, you got to be diplomatic to boot, right?
Sure. that's actually one of the things about us is that we work with a lot of different groups, a lot of different NGOs that they have their policies, their procedures, everything like that, and we don't. We basically, our motto is just get it done.
Get it done right.
And we don't care what time of day it is, what part of town it is, how dangerous it is, how stupid it is. We'll basically do whatever it takes.
So that'll lead me to my question of, so there must be just supplies and funds just sitting there, not being utilized.
There's a lot of supplies. I mean, a lot of the groups that are pulling out now have warehouses full of supplies. But the biggest problem that we're facing is that they all have their paperwork. Hmm. So, you know, right after the earthquake, you know, we could just show up somewhere, say, hey, we need this, we're taking it, and we just take what we need, distribute out what they have extra of, and we know, like, a group needs something, we grab it for them, and a lot of trading and bartering, things like that. But now, with all these groups leaving, and they have these massive stockpiles of supplies that we need access to, it's like, you've got to fill out this paperwork, it has to be approved by this person. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like the old days, right after the earthquake, where you just go in with the truck, say, hi, how's it going? I need you to step aside while I grab this.
Mm-hmm.
And, so, I mean, it was always on the up and up. It wasn't like we were, you know,
Stealing
or anything right, like that. Right. It was just, you know, we told them, like, you know, someone else needs it more than you do.
Right. Well, it's, I guess it's really triage down there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. We were talking about it last week with the fire captain and the chief. Again, those are small scales for people's homes and things, not like a country that's in rubbles. If you just join us at Disaster Recovery Hour, I'm your host, Chris Plunkett. We're talking about the Haiti and the relief funds, and then my two guests, Paul and Paul. You can catch, if you get any questions or comments, you can go on the cppems.com and you know, throw something out there while you're listening. We'll get to it. These guys are going to be in touch with me still, but with your medical background, that was probably what you did right away, besides little Paul's doing probably jack of all trades down there, right, little Paul?
My first 6-7 months up until about 2 months ago was a lot of driving. It was a lot of driving, transporting patients. I don't really have any medical background other than, like, first aid and, you know, a few other things.
We taught them how to start an IV.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you can start IVs.
I mean, definitely being around the medical teams just about 24/7, you're forced to, you know, learn a little something. But I leave that in their hands. I'm better at behind the wheel.
Right. Yeah. So regarding the other volunteers, where do they go? Are they gung-ho like you?
What we find is there's a couple types of volunteers. There's the ones that, you know, they come down with a very specific mindset that they're going to, you know, they came down with this group. You know, the group says this is what the rules are. They play by the rules. They do everything. We have a knack of being able to weed out the volunteers that come down that came down because they wanted to help, but they have no desire to play by any of the rules.
Mm.
One of those is a friend of ours, Christina. She actually was up north. I was doing a supply run up to a hospital up there. She'd committed to staying at one facility for 2 months. We talked for maybe an hour. Next thing you know, the next day, she's sitting next to me in a 28 or 32-foot box truck on an 11-hour trip down to Port-au-Prince, and she rolled with us for 2 months. And she was much more needed in Port-au-Prince, but rather than just staying and, you know, doing the lame logistics up north where, you know, anybody can do it, you know, she saw that she was needed much more down there and just kind of grabbed the bull by the horn and came with us.
So it's you and I guess it's almost like a patrol going out at night, you know, it's not a big division of people, but half a dozen of you that you got a team together? And
we've got, it's little Paul, myself, four local guys. We do have a couple of guys that are in the Marines that when they can come down, they do.
Mm.
We have about 6 to 7 volunteers that when they are available to come in country and work with us, they do. But the staple is little Paul, myself, our four local guys, and that's it.
Yeah, but, you know, it's just like I guess that old phrase up here in the United States is one vote counts. I guess one person can do a lot down there. What's the website again?
MMRCglobal.org.
And so, and trying to donate, Now, if they were to donate supplies, where would that go?
Pretty much, if you have supplies you want to donate, shoot us an email, tell us what you have, and then we'll tell you exactly what's the best route to do it. If it's large enough to fit into a container and you can pay for shipping, we'll give you the port to go to, everything like that. We'll make sure we receive it. Any kind of donations that you want to send down, if we just have a list that we can preview first to make sure you're not just sending down something that's going to go to waste.
Right.
Shoot us down what it is. We'll find it a good home.
Because, I mean, almost anything could be donated. I mean, even, I guess, toys could be donated because the kids
Absolutely.
Are around.
Oh, yeah.
Anything small that can possibly be mailed to, we have people that will organize, find out who's flying in, who's coming into country. The same thing when we're, you know, shipping stuff out. We have orphanages that make different, you know, necklaces, crafts, and things of that sort that groups that we work with that have sponsored them will auction, sell, and, you know, raise money to get supplies, food, and needs for these places. Other ones, when they're coming in, like we said, we'll organize with incoming volunteers and send it down by plane.
All right, we're going to go to break. We'll be back. We'll continue our conversations and experiences, and also we're going to pound you with the website so you people out there can donate whatever it can be. So we'll go to break.
You're listening to the Disaster Recovery Hour with your host, Chris Plunkett, on AM 970, The Apple. And now back to the Disaster Recovery Hour on AM 970, The Apple. Here's your host, Chris Plunkett.
And we're back. This is Chris Plunkett, Disaster Recovery Hour. I'm your host. Every Saturday, 7 a.m. in the morning, people going to the stores and doing your business with your bagels. You can tune me in at AM 970, The Apple, talking New York. So my guest today is Paul and Paul. You've been listening, Paul Wagoner and Paul Sebring. They formed a nonprofit organization, MMRC, Materials Management Relief Corps, and they're mmrcglobal.org if you want to donate whatever you can. So, guys, let's go. What's a typical day? Is it controlled chaos, or is there – you try to execute a plan? If you have 10 things you want to accomplish, is a successful day completing two or three or four?
You can go to bed with a plan and wake up in the morning and expect, you know, an hour or so delay, or definitely have to, you know, reevaluate what's important, because there's always something new that comes up each day. Normally we set out to do something. We get 90% of it done a day, and then, you know, fall in play the next day, pick up where we left off. But for the most part, it's we take care of whatever we have scheduled. You can guarantee that, you know, a hospital or two or more are going to call for some form of transfer, whether it be an x-ray or, you know, getting a patient, a burn patient from an ER that's not equipped to take care of it to whoever is. And that's where, you know, BP comes in very good. He's like the information hub for who's at what hospital and, you know, where you can get, you know, any kind of care.
Is this still dealing with the earthquake victims, or is this daily, just your now it's your ordinary EMT type of work?
What it's looking like right now is, I mean, granted, it's your everyday, you know, natural stuff that happens in an EMT or a EMS environment in a country. But what's happening right now is with the rains, there's a lot of unsecured structures, buildings that didn't collapse all the way. And the 10 cities still are up there. You know, you've got 1.3 million people displaced. You've got all of them, what's it now, like 1,500 tent cities. The rains are coming. These are tents that were put in, or tarps that were put in right after the earthquake. Little camping tents that are good for, you know, a weekend here, a weekend there. People have been living in them for 9 months. They've fallen apart. So they've got to find shelter somewhere else. So they go into these buildings that aren't completely safe. And then with the rains coming in and the poor construction pre-earthquake, a lot of these buildings are collapsing. So now you're looking at technically earthquake-related victims, but not right after the earthquake.
So is the Haitian government, do they have anything in set up and running yet, or is it still in the works?
Have you seen anything? I mean, I've seen minimal when I was there. I mean, it's not like a response like you would expect to see here in the States, that, you know, all this money got raised for Haiti and everything like that, but virtually none of the money's been released. It's still sitting God knows where. And the locals are doing the best that they can with what they have. But it's just like, you know, for the massive effort that needs to be involved, you know, I'm not seeing.
Well, yeah. Probably about 3 weeks ago, the UN escorted an NGO through some of the downtown tent cities distributing tents after a pretty nasty storm came through. It was a lot of wind, came in within seconds, and wiped out a lot of groups that we work with, bases, and the tent cities were, you know, definitely wiped out. If they're lucky, they're in a tent. A lot of them are in, you know, tarps tied to just wooden posts sticking up here and there, and they're shredding. You know, so when the wind came through, it was easy to take them away. You've seen stuff all over the roads, tarps, pieces of tents, tent poles, stuff in trees. And pulling through there with the UN escort was a group giving out, you know, as many tents as they could. But for the most part, it's just a temporary fix. And
9 months old now.
Right. And any good rain that comes through, I mean, if you've ever been out camping and, you know, even a sprinkle, you get a lot of condensation inside your tent. If you're, you know, lucky, you're on a cot. For most cases, they're sleeping on blankets directly on the ground, which are absorbing this condensation, keeping their clothes and everything mildewed and wet, and just really poor conditions to live in.
So I take it the burn victims are from when the tents, what they catch on fire because they're cooking in them?
Cooking in them, or they've got everything stored in them. And what we've noticed, too, is, like, we had one where LP and I had to do a transfer, three burn victims, 90% burns. They all died, unfortunately. But the thing is, like, one tent caught fire, then another tent caught fire, right. Things like that. But, you know, the fires is not so much the – it is a big concern, but what's the major concern is the spread of infectious disease, like tuberculosis, for example. There's a doctor we work with down there, and she's running a TB ward by herself. And you've got to figure tuberculosis is spread by, you know, droplets. So they just take a bunch of people, cram them into a tent city where there's no electricity, no height, no sanitation, no nothing. Have 2,000-3,000 people living face-to-face pretty much. Throw a couple live active TB patients in there, and it's going to spread like wildfire.
Right. So is there you have all these 1.3 million people displaced. Is it all in tent cities, or is there any structures that have been repaired or safed off?
If they do happen to have a home that's still standing, the majority of them are so scared that they'll stay in a tent city just a few yards away from wherever their home is.
Where's the electricity coming from? Is it all gas-driven generators?
There was a lot of areas that were still lacking electricity, and the recent flooding, I'm not sure where we stand. I happen to have just got out of country before that happened. I'll be heading back on Monday, and I can figure out more about that. But a few weeks ago, we had a terrible storm come through. And there's still a ton of areas that have no electricity. So you hear generators, if people are fortunate enough to have them, and inverters, you know, that are running sets of batteries. For the most part, it's really dark right now. A lot of power's not on, and you know, the majority of areas, even downtown, and some of the more bourgeois neighborhoods.
Is there So what about water? What are they doing for – I mean, you guys got to drink water. What are you guys drinking?
We
drink a lot of Coke, Dr. Yeah. Pepper, if we can find – no. No, they've got – that's the whole thing. That's the crazy thing is they do have water purification plants there. Culligan's pretty big there. They do have reverse osmosis. And they've got it all over the place because everybody – nobody can really drink the local water. You can't drink the water, so the entire country is dependent upon, you know, reverse osmosis water. We've had actually the first time we were there, we actually had the Coast Guard go in and test the local water sources where they were doing filtration, and they said it was some of the most pure water they've ever seen.
Really?
They actually told us to, if we're going to leave it in a 5-gallon jug, to add a touch of chlorine to it because it's so pure, stuff will actually grow in it. So water purification-wise, it's fine. The problem is you got to have money to buy it. So you've got to have money to buy that. Like LP was saying about the storm LP's talking about, that happened on September 24th. It still hasn't recovered from that yet. You've got the generators, and you've got the fuel. Runs off diesel. Diesel's what, like 525 a gallon?
Easy.
Yeah, 525 to 550 U.S. a gallon. So how are you going to power a generator when you don't even have money?
Right. So is there what about the police department? Is that up and running? Or is it like bands of, you know, your neighborhood watchdog?
No, the police are pretty active, and we have some very good contacts within the police departments, the different branches of their law enforcement that are, you know, amazing people, and they really look out for us, and they like what we're doing. They follow us. You know, we have meetings, conversations on the phone from time to time to keep up with what's going on. We're recently had a meeting with one of our contacts within the national police and discussed the month of November and how elections were going to go down and how we felt security was going to be, and making somewhat of a plan just in case. Expect the worst, you know, but hope for the best.
It's a little hostile during their election years, is it down there?
I guess, you know, in the past, it kind of leads you, you know, it promises to be eventful. Mm-hmm. We'll hope for the best.
Mm. Well, if you want to follow us on the Twitter, it's twitter.com/DRH Radio. You can catch some of this program on there, and also the podcast. You can put in your email address, and you can listen to me and the guys talk about the Haiti situation, which is definitely not going away anytime soon.
No, not anytime soon at all.
So, now for your eating and your drinking and your living, what are you guys? Where are you staying?
We actually were lucky enough that we found a house that we could rent. It's got 5 bedrooms and 4 baths that we keep available to volunteers. Since we, you know, basically we have no income, what we do is we rent it out to groups that are coming in. LP and I, we each have our own tent, and we actually sleep in a tent. Granted, it's under it's a covered area that we sleep in, so it's not directly out in the environment. Mm-hmm. But two reasons. One is, you know, it keeps the house available for other people that want to come through. But primarily, when you wake up every morning in a tent, you realize that other people are doing it as well, you know, the locals. So it kind of keeps you focused as to why you're there.
Yeah. I don't know what the government was like beforehand, but look at Katrina. And do you see similarities there? I mean, because the breakdown of social services down in New Orleans was very heightened, and everyone saw it on the television. I had a couple of my friends go down there. Because I had done the hurricanes in Florida 5 years before, and I had my time away from my home, so I wasn't about to go do it again. My wife wouldn't let me anyway. But so you see there are differences, similarities?
I would say it's completely different because, I mean, here we have the resources.
Right.
You know, we had everything. There, they had nothing.
Right.
I grew up in Florida, and I've seen tons of hurricanes and never anything on this level.
But, I mean, you know, FEMA came into light after the towers went down when I worked downtown. You know, they were calling all the shots, and they were supposed to do the same thing down in Katrina. But you know, having all those people in the Superdome, that's a large tent city right there. But it's definitely out of the elements. So what is the local government down there doing?
You know, it's tough to really keep up with a lot of stuff there on the ground when we're staying so busy. It's hard to say one way or another. You do see progress, and they are getting things done. It does seem like they're starting to pull together, but there's still a huge need for help. They've got to coordinate, and they need things like we have here: devices, better communications. The police. We're trying to work with different agencies and get EMT classes started. They work on street corners. Some of them have bulletproof vests. Some of them don't. You know, they're all in need of them. It's really dangerous. It's constant. People are getting robbed. Motorcycles are getting stolen, and so on and so forth. So they're definitely doing their job to the best of their ability. And they're putting a great effort in, dealing with what they have to deal with.
We're going to go to break. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Disaster Recovery Hour with your host, Chris Plunkett, on AM 970, The Apple. And now back to the Disaster Recovery Hour on AM 970, The Apple. Here's your host, Chris Plunkett.
And we're back. If you just joined us, you're late. Won't be forgiven on that. Hey, Big Paul, why don't you, you had an article in Men's Health? I got it right here.
Yeah, it was Men's Journal.
Men's Journal?
Last month's issue. They did a write-up on, the article is called Haiti's Cowboy EMTs. You can actually find that article on our website, which is mmrcglobal.org. Pretty much what it talks about is twin brothers Kit and Cody Doucette came down to cover MediShare, University of Miami Field Hospital, and our name kept popping up whenever they were talking to the staff there. They followed us around. The first day we met them, basically they wanted to know what is an average day for us. We were doing a supply run. We were taking a break. The chief medical officer of MediShare was with us, got a call that there were 30 people in an accident. So long story short, ran over to the compound that we live at, geared up, went to the general hospital, commandeered a couple ambulances, rolled out to Mission of Hope Hospital, where we proceeded to help in the transport of 30 victims to MediShare. And the next day we evac'd five Americans, because there was 15 Americans involved in this accident. We evac'd five of them out to the States for head trauma.
Hey, you know, you and I were talking before in the elevator. What's that the insurance you were talking about?
It's something like a evacuation insurance where if you get seriously injured and have to be evacuated out, it covers your in-country transportation, your private jet to the hospital where you're going to be received at, and your treatment in the hospital that you're at.
And do you also get flown out if it need be?
Yeah, we in Port-au-Prince they can only receive two private jets at a time, so we just take a back entrance into the hospital with whatever transportation we have and load the patient up into there. There's two nurses and a respiratory therapist that come in on this private jet, and then they evac you out of the country.
So. So we have the electricity issues still. You have the water issues. So at the beginning of the day, or at the end of the day, there's so many things that just need. There's not that one thing that needs to be done. Everything needs to be done, right, Little Paul?
From one end of the spectrum to the other.
I mean, so you got supplies, and then what about the psychological effect? What's happening? I mean, people being addressed with the trauma from that, or is it is that on the back burner until the physical part of it's taken care of? What's your feeling?
There are groups there that come in here and there, but you know that's something that really requires long-term help. So I'm not sure exactly.
There really isn't. I mean, the thing is this: like the Haitian people, they're resilient. I mean, PTSD, yeah, it's running rampant through the country and everything like that. But at the same time, they also understand that someone else has it worse than they do. They're lucky to be alive. Mm-hmm. And they will just start picking up the pieces and try and put their lives back together. I'll tell you this much right now. If this were to hit the U.S. and we were to have to live in the conditions that they're living in right now, there's no way. I don't know anyone that'd survive. Yep. They have no food, electricity, sanitation, water, nothing.
And, we take a lot of things for granted in our country, don't we?
Yeah.
But the website, again, I'm going to keep on pounding that. It's mmrcglobal.org. And like inside that article, there's photographs of Little Paul and Big Paul in the field. So from here on out, what are your plans, Little Paul?
My plan is I'm going to enjoy the last couple of days I have in the States here, head back down to Haiti, and spend another 3 months, hopefully, with a lot more progress, and maybe come back then, take another break, and head down again. We have, like I said, we have our couple guys from the U.S. Marine Corps that just showed up today. Our Haitian volunteers, Junior and Ralph, picked them up from the airport, got them settled in at the house, and we're looking to pick back up on our EMT classes throughout the hospitals and with the local police departments, and pretty much just pick up where we left off a couple days ago when I got out.
What about you, Big Paul?
Pretty much I came back 4 weeks ago to do fundraising, and my goal is to hopefully be out of here by the middle of November. We've got some incredible people we're working with, because MMRC, our footprint that we want to leave in Haiti, our long-term commitment is establishing a 911 and EMS system so that in 5 years from now, nobody remembers who we were. But they've got a 911 dispatch available, EMTs, paramedics, trainers, ambulances, the whole nine yards. And we've got the people on the Haitians that want to learn. We have a lot of volunteers here that want to go down. But it's pretty much establishing, you know, getting the funding so we can do it. And hopefully that'll happen to where I can get out of here in a few weeks.
So again, it's the mmrcglobal.org. So where do you go from here? What do you what's your feeling on the future and the next generation of kids in the country, Liverpool?
I believe that education is the root of it all. If we start educating the younger kids, they'll come up and, you know, that they won't allow all these you know, shady governments to take control of the country. They'll have a, you know, a better idea, a positive outlook for their country's future. And like our guys, you know, that work with us do, we have three kids that we have in school. One's 19, four, she's not attended since fourth grade. We have him a private teacher that comes to the house. Ellie is a street kid that started helping us when we assisted University of Miami Medical and moving their field hospital into a regular hospital structure more near town. He came on. He hadn't been in school since fourth grade. He's like 15 years old. Wow. He's also being tutored. We've worked on getting his birth certificate. We stay real tight with these people's families. They assist us, and, you know, we'll come up with the money to get a birth certificate, get a, you know, a passport to get them, you know, back in the United States to finish their education if they were here going to school at one time. We have a girl that was recently rewarded a scholarship to Toulouse and is looking to find a sponsor in order to acquire her visa. She needs to have an apartment and a small amount of money to get through each year in an account. And we've been working with her on that.
How can someone get a hold? Is that just through mmrcglobal.org?
mmrcglobal.org. I have a blog. BP has a blog. I've recently put a lot of this information about a few of these people we're helping on there, and they can follow that. There are donation spots on there. Also, a couple other individuals and groups that we work with are doing things stateside to try to, you know, get funding to continue purchasing books for orphanages, the schools that we work with, the kids that are at our place that are being tutored privately until they're, you know, ready to be put back in a school.
Big Paul, with your fundraising, it's just trying to get face to face with people and to for the donations and hear about what's happening down there. Still, is that correct?
Yeah, it is. Yes, I've been trying to meet face to face with groups. I've met some individuals that want to try and help with grant writing to get some of the big dollars out there, because it's going to cost about $3 million over 5 years to get the 911 system up and running and the training. But for now, everything we've been doing is on private donations. And, you know, the people, once they hear our story, they meet us in person, see what we're doing there, they know that every dollar that you donate is going straight to the work we're doing. We don't have these monstrous administrative fees that everyone else does.
Right. The smaller the group, you're getting more things bang for your buck, if you will, right? So the website is mmrcglobal.org. Again, mmrcglobal.org. This has been a Disaster Recovery Hour. I'm your host every Saturday at 7 a.m., AM 970 The Apple, talking New York. Enjoy the rest of the weekend. Guys, a pleasure. I'm glad the internet hooked us up. Not like internet dating, but it's a pleasure, a real pleasure. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Disaster Recovery Hour with your host, Chris Plunkett, from CPP Emergency Services and Restoration. You can reach Chris by calling 201-483-8953. And don't forget to tune in every Saturday morning at 7 for the Disaster Recovery Hour, right here on AM 970, The Apple.